McNamara thought that the primary contribution of ground forces would be to signal resolve to Hanoi and gave his tentative endorsement to Taylor's enclave concept. Taylor and McNamara together overruled the chief's call for an intensification of Rolling Thunder. Taylor argued that the latest airstrikes had established a good tempo. To forestall opposition from the JCS, McNamara held out the promise of future action. The defense secretary suggested that in 4 to 12 weeks, the mining of Haiphong Harbor and other actions that the chiefs had previously recommended might become politically feasible. McNamara assured the chiefs that if they supported restrictions on the air campaign in the short term, they would eventually be permitted to place very strong pressure on North Vietnam. Despite LBJ's efforts to minimize his recent decisions to intensify and widen the U.S. effort in Vietnam, public and congressional opposition to his policy had increased in March. Discontent over the president's policy was growing principally on college campuses and among liberal intellectuals. A State Department white paper designed to prove North Vietnamese complicity in the insurgency in the South was weak in its argument and short on evidence, the bulk of which remained classified. A week prior to Taylor's arrival in Washington, the students and faculty at the University of Michigan held the first Vietnam War teach-in to voice opposition to the president's policy. In response to the growing opposition, LBJ redoubled his effort to prevent leaks and to conceal deepening American involvement in the war. The president denied that his policy had changed significantly since his election in November. On April 1st, an hour before he met with his advisors on Vietnam, he held an impromptu press conference in the White House Theater. Johnson emphasized progress in getting Great Society legislation through Congress. When asked specifically about his Vietnam policy, he highlighted continuity with previous administrations, claiming that he was simply honoring the commitment to the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, or CETO, that Eisenhower and Congress had made. Johnson cited the Gulf of Tonkin resolution as evidence of congressional support for his policy and stated that he knew of no division in the American government over Vietnam. To dispel reports that he was discussing major military decisions during Taylor's visit, he denied knowledge of any far-reaching strategy that is being suggested or promulgated. He said that those who publicly opposed his Vietnam policy and journalists who speculated about it disregarded our soldiers who were dying in Vietnam. Immediately after the press conference, the president joined McCone, Rusk, McNamara, Wheeler, McNaughton, Taylor, and the Bundy brothers for consultation on Vietnam. Johnson made it clear at the outset that the meeting was off the record and that no great decisions would be reached. Rusk and CIA Director McCone expressed doubts about the effectiveness of the airstrikes against the North and suggested that North Vietnamese leaders, even if they were so inclined, would not be able to call off the insurgency in the South. The president seemed frustrated, wondering how he could get his feet on their neck. In contrast to his tone at the press conference, he ended his opening remarks with the statement, "We've got to find him and kill him." General Wheeler picked up on the president's exhortation with an argument for the expansion of the air campaign and the deployment of ground combat units to Vietnam. Although inter-service disputes had prevented the JCS from generating its own proposal, Wheeler argued that the 12-week bombing program developed under McNamara's guidance was inadequate. It did not make sense militarily to avoid hitting the MiG airfields in North Vietnam. Because the United States was losing the war, the president should approve the JCS recommendation to deploy the remainder of a Marine division, a U.S. Army division, and a South Korean division. Wheeler argued that ground forces would have a major effect on the war. signal American determination and purpose to North Vietnam, serve as a deterrent to escalation, position U.S. military power forward if deterrence failed, and provide bargaining leverage for negotiations. Wheeler pressed the president for a decision, telling him that with three divisions and logistical improvements, your problem is solved. Wheeler, minimizing the cost of his proposal, noted that reserve forces would not have to deploy and could be used to replenish the strategic reserve. Instead of producing a debate on the nature of the problem in Vietnam and examining possible U.S. responses, Wheeler's proposal ran into the president's preoccupation with consensus and his desire to keep American involvement in the war as quiet as possible. The president took a middle course designed to satisfy all parties. Johnson deferred making a decision on Wheeler's three-division recommendation. Instead, he approved the deployment of two additional Marine battalions and expanded the Marine mission from defensive security to offensive counterinsurgency operations. In the long run, the change of mission that committed American troops to offensive combat was more significant than the deployment of additional troops. But the former decision was easier to conceal from the American public in the short term. The president reassured Wheeler that he would consider sending additional forces to Vietnam in the near future and told him to prepare two American divisions for deployment. After the meeting, Director of Central Intelligence McCone realized that the president had made his decision without an informed, comprehensive estimate of the situation and without considering fully the consequences of expanding the mission of U.S. ground forces in Vietnam. McCone attempted to relate the issue of additional ground forces to the ongoing Rolling Thunder campaign and challenged Taylor's assertion that the tempo of the airstrikes was about right. In a memo to Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, McNamara, and Taylor, McCone argued that the bombing had not been sufficiently heavy and damaging, really, to hurt the North Vietnamese, and had only hardened their attitude. Although Taylor had excised paragraphs of CIA reports that questioned the effectiveness of the airstrikes, McCone's officers in Saigon had forwarded unedited versions of the reports through back-channel communications. McCone argued that the decisions to change the mission of U.S. ground forces in Vietnam to one of active combat was correct only if we hit North Vietnam harder, more frequently, and inflict greater damage. He urged, instead of avoiding the MiGs, we must go in and take them out. A bridge here and there will not do the job. We must strike their airfields, their petroleum resources, power stations, and their military compounds. This, in my opinion, must be done promptly and with minimal restraint. If we are unwilling to take this kind of decision now, we must not take the actions concerning the mission of our ground forces. McCone warned that unless the president made a clear choice between a negotiated settlement and a decisive expansion of the war, the United States would incur an ever-increasing commitment of U.S. personnel without materially improving the chance of victory. The president heard McCone's views in a National Security Council meeting on April 2nd, but he remained resolved to take only the minimal actions necessary to prevent defeat in South Vietnam. McCone had become increasingly frustrated with his limited access to the president, as well as with the administration's apparent disinterest in intelligence. Unlike graduated pressure, McCone's assessment provided no easy solutions to the problem in Vietnam and demanded, in effect, that the president make a difficult choice between commitment to a large-scale war and a negotiated withdrawal. Johnson, however, would not make a tough decision that would alienate constituencies on which his great society depended. 3 weeks after he composed his memo, McCone resigned in frustration. Although he had come to the same conclusion as McCone about what the situation in Vietnam demanded, Wheeler did not consider resignation. He responded to the president's reluctance to commit fully to either negotiation or the use of military force by pressing for a gradual intensification of the war effort, as the president's domestic political concerns permitted. His approach allowed Johnson to avoid deciding whether to go to war in Vietnam, even as the country sank deeper into that war. The president remained more interested in preserving consensus about his policy than in entertaining a wide-ranging discussion on the situation in Vietnam. Taylor's final meeting in Washington revealed that the principal purpose of his visit had been to preserve the superficial harmony and consensus among the president's principal Vietnam advisors. In a meeting with Taylor and the Bundy brothers, Russ told Taylor that the president felt that he must not force the pace too fast or the Congress and the public opinion, which had been held in line up to now through the president's strenuous efforts, would no longer support our actions in Vietnam. Rusk emphasized that Taylor must keep the few decisions that the president did make as quiet as possible. The Secretary of State recognized that Taylor would have to get South Vietnamese permission to deploy the additional Marines, but did not yet want to give up the ability to describe their mission as defensive. Rusk attempted to qualify the president's decision on the mission change by suggesting that the Marines already in country delay offensive operations until the additional battalions join them, and by claiming that any offensive be described as aggressive patrolling. Under no circumstances would Taylor indicate to the South Vietnamese government that the president was considering large-scale American troop deployments. At the end of the meeting, McGeorge Bundy, who had congratulated the president for his personal achievement in presenting his decisions to expand the war within the framework of a continuing policy and a continuing purpose and not as major new departures, stressed to Taylor the need for very tight public information controls on these matters. Taylor indicated that he now understood the situation in the United States. Assured of harmony within his administration, the president moved to diffuse opposition from those who favored an immediate move toward a negotiated settlement. Since first authorizing continuing action against North Vietnam in mid-February, he had ignored and discouraged calls for negotiation. He shared Taylor's view that an early willingness to negotiate would appear to the North Vietnamese as a sign of weakness. Johnson told Ball that early calls for negotiation had him feeling as if he were getting crowded into a corner. Johnson instructed Ball to act as his lawyer and forestall calls for negotiations until North Vietnam had felt the effects of the bombing campaign. In response to peace initiatives from the British Prime Minister, the Secretary General of the UN, and others, the president threatened to get sick and leave town to avoid having to receive their proposals. By the end of March, however, it had become apparent to the president they would have to confront growing public and congressional opposition to his policy. Democratic Senators Mansfield and McGovern had warned him that his policy of expanding the American military effort in Vietnam would have dire consequences. Mansfield argued that U.S. interests on the Southeast Asian mainland did not justify the cost in lives and resources. He urged Johnson to pursue negotiations even if the United States had to accept a less than favorable settlement. Just as he had used tough language to convince the JCS of his determination to commit whatever force was necessary in Vietnam, the president turned to the language of peace to quell opposition to military action. On March 25th, 2 days after receiving Mansfield's memo, and the day after the University of Michigan teach-in, Johnson released a statement that stressed the limited nature of American military actions in Vietnam and cited his readiness to go anywhere at any time and meet with anyone whenever there is promise of progress toward an honorable peace. The president hoped that there would be a time when Southeast Asia would be free from terror, subversion, and assassination, and would be able to reap the benefits of economic and social cooperation with the United States. 1 week later, Averill Harriman sent a memo to McGeorge Bundy, urging the president to develop more fully a proposal for economic development for both Vietnams. Harriman suggested that to regain the support of those who had begun to question the president's Vietnam policy, Johnson offered North Vietnam a political and economic carrot in the form of an exported great society. Bundy, who had come to believe that the president ought to give the American public a more detailed exposition of our conditions for peace and our view of the future in Southeast Asia, began to draft a speech for the president. LBJ chose April 7th to deliver a nationally televised address on Vietnam at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. In that much-publicized speech, Johnson reemphasized his commitment to guarantee the independence of South Vietnam and its freedom from attack, and stressed the continuity between his policy and that of President Eisenhower in the 1950s. He vowed never to be second in the search for a peaceful settlement in Vietnam. While emphasizing his commitment to the use of military force, Johnson held out the promise of a comprehensive economic and public works development program for all of Southeast Asia. He evoked images of progress that, as a New Deal congressman and senator, he had helped bring to his native Texas Hill Country. He promised North Vietnam a Mekong River development program that would provide food and water and power on a scale to dwarf even our own TVA, or Tennessee Valley Authority, and revolutionary advances in medical care, agriculture, and education. Under Johnson's program, North Vietnam could feed its people with food from American warehouses and allow its people to trade in their rags for decent clothing. Johnson's words, as he and his advisors had described them at lunch the day before, were aimed at placating the Sob Sisters and Peace Societies in the United States. The president's stated objective of an independent South Vietnam, securely guaranteed and able to shape its own relationships to all others, free from outside interference, was non-negotiable to North Vietnamese leaders, who remained determined to unite Vietnam under Hanoi's domination. The North Vietnamese Politburo had concluded that negotiations would only be useful to pave the way for a U.S. withdrawal with a lesser loss of face. They planned to negotiate only after the insurrection in the South succeeded. The day after the Johns Hopkins speech, Hanoi responded with 4 points as preconditions for any negotiations. The United States was to withdraw unconditionally from Vietnam. A coalition government in the South, which Hanoi planned to dominate, would be formed to negotiate the unification of Vietnam. Until that government was formed, the Viet Cong's political arm, the National Liberation Front, would be the only legitimate representative of the Vietnamese people. Although it had taken less than 24 hours for Ho to reject LBJ's export version of the Great Society, the response in the United States was generally positive. Former ambassador to India, economist John Kenneth Galbraith, who had recently returned to the faculty of Harvard University and would become an outspoken critic of the Vietnam War, wrote an open letter to the New York Times. Galbraith praised the president's reversal of what had seemed a military approach to the problem in Vietnam and expressed relief that Johnson was not embarking upon an infantry war in Asia. When Galbraith wrote his letter to the editor, however, U.S. Marines had already received orders to begin offensive killing operations, and two additional Marine infantry battalions, one Marine air squadron, and 20,000 logistical troops capable of supporting three more divisions of combat troops were preparing for deployment to South Vietnam. In pursuit of consensus and not wanting to confront the implications of his decisions, the president had quietly committed the United States to war. The body charged with providing the president with military advice and responsible for strategic planning permitted the president to commit the United States to war without consideration of the likely costs and consequences. Comprehensive estimates of the number of troops necessary to win existed, but to conceal inter-service divisions and to increase the likelihood that the president would approve the actions that they recommended, the Joint Chiefs suppressed them. In late January 1965, Vice Admiral Rufus Taylor, Director of Naval Intelligence, had reported to Admiral MacDonald that the United States should be prepared at an early date to either commit U.S. forces in sufficient strength to ensure victory for our side or get out before it is too late. A JCS study conducted under the direction of the Marine Corps staff estimated that 700,000 troops would be needed to win in Vietnam. Harold Johnson had concluded that it would probably take 5 years and 500,000 men to defeat the insurgency in the South. The failure of early Rolling Thunder strikes came as no surprise to Admiral MacDonald and Harold K. Johnson, but neither had expressed his doubts about the bombing to his civilian superiors. They accepted an open-ended commitment to fight in Vietnam, rather than press for the deployment of the number of troops that they thought would be required to win the war, or develop a strategic plan integrating the air, ground, and naval efforts into a coherent military program. Each member of the JCS continued to suppress his reservations about the strategy of graduated pressure and optimistically advanced his own service's solution to the problem. The chiefs, however, had given the president the military advice he wanted, while excluding the JCS from substantive deliberations. LBJ and McNamara bought the support of the military with a combination of pro forma consultation and promises of stronger action in the future. With Rolling Thunder underway and combat units arriving in South Vietnam, the JCS had begun to press McNamara and Johnson to deliver on their promises. It was time for LBJ to communicate to the JCS precisely what he expected from his military advisors. Chapter 13, The Coach and His Team, April to June, 1965. Maybe we military men were all weak. Maybe we should have stood up and pounded the table. I was part of it, and I'm sort of ashamed of myself, too. At times I wonder, why did I go along with this kind of stuff? Admiral David Lamar MacDonald, 1976. In the spring and summer of 1965, LBJ was responding to political pressures, having placated the Sob Sisters and Peace Societies with his April 7th Johns Hopkins speech. The president felt compelled to respond to pressure from another quarter, the Joint Chiefs. Indeed, 2 days prior to the president's speech, McNamara asked the JCS for a detailed schedule for the introduction into Vietnam of a force of 2 to 3 divisions at the earliest practicable date. Assuming that the president would soon approve the deployment, the JCS ordered units to prepare for shipment to South Vietnam. Lieutenant General Birkenau, the director of the Joint Staff, cabled SINCPAC, expressing the JCS's desire to ram logistical units into South Vietnam as rapidly as MACV wants them and we can send them in order to prepare for the support of large ground combat forces. The first confirmed reports that North Vietnamese regular army units had infiltrated into the South added urgency to JCS recommendations for an intensification of the air campaign against the North and for deployment of 3 divisions to South Vietnam. Johnson, however, was unwilling even to entertain the chief's recommendations. He was impressed by the vehemence and strength of the anti-bombing protests and feared that the large-scale troop deployments the chiefs were recommending would raise to a higher level the public and congressional attention directed toward the war. He was still concerned that greater congressional scrutiny on Vietnam meant less attention to the Great Society. He responded to competing pressures with decisions that he hoped would satisfy, or at least placate, critics and potential critics. He refused to consider an intensification of the Rolling Thunder air campaign because it would incite further protests and opposition. He would, however, approve small increases in the level of force in South Vietnam and change the mission of U.S. ground units from defensive to offensive operations, actions, in other words, that he could conceal from the American public and Congress. Units smaller than division size already stationed overseas could be relocated to South Vietnam with less fanfare than the deployment of entire divisions from the United States. Offensive operations could be portrayed as active patrolling in support of what the administration would continue to describe as a primarily defensive operation. The president hoped that his middle course, dependent on lies and obfuscation, would minimize criticism from those opposed to deepening American involvement in the war, as well as those, like the JCS, who urged further action. To continue to hold the middle ground on Vietnam, the president needed the cooperation of the Joint Chiefs. Because he was deceiving the American people and the Congress, keeping the chiefs on the team would become more important to him than it had been previously. The JCS had recognized that graduated pressure was a strategy driven by domestic political objectives. Most of all, the introduction of ground troops to Vietnam was the first natural breakpoint in Johnson's Vietnam policy since graduated pressure had become the administration's strategy in March 1964. The arrival of ground troops in South Vietnam and their employment in offensive operations against the Viet Cong gave the chiefs an opportunity to voice their opposition to Johnson's Vietnam policy. Indeed, the chiefs attempted to press the president to take more resolute action in Southeast Asia. They reached an agreement to tell the president that the immediate deployment of 3 divisions was necessary to win the war in Vietnam. Wheeler asked his colleagues to stand firmly behind this recommendation. The chiefs failed, however, to take advantage of a clear opportunity to question Johnson's policy, and graduated pressure continued to guide the deployment of ground troops while the president's advisors focused on tactical details rather than on strategic issues. From April through June of 1965, the president failed to confront the likely consequences of military actions, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff continued to recommend an escalation of the military effort without presenting a strategy aimed at forcing an outcome consistent with U.S. interests. Johnson's determination to conceal the scale of America's deepening military involvement in Vietnam militated against approving the chief's recommendations. Although he authorized the deployment of 2 additional Marine battalions and 1 air squadron, he was particularly concerned about changing, without the knowledge of Congress, the Marines' mission from defensive to offensive combat operations. In a National Security Action Memorandum issued on April 6th, the president approved a change of mission for all Marine battalions deployed to Vietnam, to permit their more active use under conditions to be established and approved by the Secretary of Defense in consultation with the Secretary of State. The final paragraph of the National Security Action Memorandum made clear the President's desire to avoid premature publicity about his recent decisions. Although the actions themselves should be taken as rapidly as practicable, the military should minimize any appearance of sudden changes in policy. Only the Secretaries of Defense and State could issue official statements concerning troop deployments and mission changes. Finally, the National Security Action Memorandum reemphasized that these movements and changes should be understood as being gradual and wholly consistent with existing policy. Meanwhile, because of international and domestic political pressure to stop Rolling Thunder, LBJ assured the American people that he would continue to exercise restraint in connection with the air campaign. Concerned about this issue, Johnson arranged a meeting on April 8, 1965, the day after the Johns Hopkins speech, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, McNamara, and Deputy Secretary of Defense, Vance. The President was determined to avoid any discussion of the bombing of North Vietnam and made it clear to the Chiefs that he expected results in Vietnam even under the restrictions that he had placed on air and ground operations. The Joint Chiefs, however, based on assessments that Rolling Thunder had not reduced the overall military capability of Vietnamese communist forces in any major way, continued to recommend lifting the restrictions on the air campaign. Using enlarged photographs, Wheeler recounted recent Rolling Thunder strikes on two key bridges in North Vietnam. McConnell noted that U.S. aircraft had dropped 432 bombs on one bridge and, although it was damaged, no part of it had been knocked down. Two American fighters, furthermore, had been shot down by North Vietnamese MiGs. The President asked the Chiefs what had gone wrong with the attack. McConnell responded apologetically that neither mission had been well planned or executed. He promised that missions would improve in the future and noted that he had sent to South Vietnam a team of four men to get them straightened out. He made no mention, however, of the continued prohibition against targeting the enemy's fighter bases as a possible contributing factor to the fate of the two Air Force F-105s. The President said, "It looks to me as if the boys are inexperienced." Nodding in agreement, McConnell muttered that this was so. The Chiefs allowed the President to blame the mission's failure on the boys who executed it, rather than emphasize how both the restrictions on the amount of force and the rules of engagement compromised the Rolling Thunder attacks. They therefore put themselves on the defensive, rather than force the President to face the consequences of his policies. LBJ told the JCS, "Now, I'm like a coach I used to know, and you're my team. You're all Johnson men." Referring to the situation in Vietnam, the President continued with his metaphor. "We played the first half of the game, and the score is now 21-0 against us. Now I want you to tell me how to win." LBJ's eyes turned to Wheeler. "You're graduates of the military academy, and you should be able to give me an answer. I want you to come back here next Tuesday and tell me how we are going to kill more Viet Cong." The President appeared committed to invest whatever level of force the JCS determined was necessary to win the war in the South. He observed that, "At present, we are limited as to what we can do in North Vietnam, but we have almost free rein in South Vietnam, and I want to kill more Viet Cong." Although he had essentially placed any discussion of intensifying the air campaign against North Vietnam off limits, Johnson pledged a willingness to spend the money and, if necessary, to move the Joint Chiefs of Staff right out to Saigon to improve the situation. He asked them to tell him what we can do to win, despite his professed desire to win, the president attempted to exact from the chiefs a recommendation consistent with his desire to maintain domestic political consensus. He hoped to generate among them an understanding of his need to limit military action against the North. He told them that he was having trouble with Congress and the public. He leaned backward in his chair, pointing out a pile of telegrams on the desk behind him. He told the JCS that the telegrams were all criticisms of the speech I made last night at Johns Hopkins. I thought I was doing pretty well. I got 14 applauses in 40 minutes, but those letters don't look that way. After making clear his insecurity and need for support, Coach Johnson told his team what he expected. First, the president wanted the JCS to prevent criticisms from the field from reaching the media and the American public. He referred to recent press reports that the war had been controlled too tightly from Washington and told the JCS that, as long as I'm commander-in-chief, I'm going to control from Washington. He ordered Wheeler to identify and punish those who had complained to reporters. Wheeler promised that he would. Johnson then told the JCS to shift their strategic focus away from the controversial bombing of North Vietnam and toward additional action in South Vietnam. He asked Wheeler, "How many Viet Cong have we killed since you were here last time?" Wheeler had no figures, so Deputy Secretary of Defense Vance helped the chairman make an estimate. The president appeared disappointed. He wanted to know how many Viet Cong have been killed since the 1st of January and how many Vietnamese have been killed by the Viet Cong and how many Americans. It appeared that the president, having discussed the war in terms of a football game, was intent on keeping score by tracking the numbers of dead on both sides. Green, who had grown frustrated with the disparity between the president's tough talk and limitations on the use of force, leaned forward and told Johnson, "Mr. President, the last time I came over here was last month on the 15th of March. When I left the meeting that day, I had the clear idea you wanted more VC killed. I thought that you really meant that, but here it is, almost a month later, the 8th of April, and we are just getting permission to modify our security mission to permit us to go out and kill Viet Cong. Furthermore, we're just getting approval from the Vietnamese government for the introduction of more Marines into the Da Nang area, and I also assume approval of a combat killing mission for the Da Nang Marine Forces." Green told the president that the Marine Force currently in the South, two reinforced battalions of about 1,600 men each, was inadequate. Green used the president's demand to kill more Viet Cong to argue for a much larger U.S. Marine effort in South Vietnam. He observed that offensive operations against the enemy would require additional troops and suggested that the Marine commander on the ground be given the authority to bring in as many Marines from the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force based in Okinawa as he deemed necessary to expand his operations. Green suggested that South Vietnamese Marine units supplement U.S. Marine forces to conduct combined Viet Cong killing operations, noting that the Marines were trained to operate together as an air-ground team. He observed that a Marine air squadron was not yet positioned in Da Nang. Once the first squadron arrived, he would need a second to operate in close teamwork with our ground Marines. LBJ was not yet prepared to consider specific proposals. Having told the JCS why further action against the North was out of the question, and having communicated his need for support, he deferred any consideration of Green's recommendation until their next meeting. He told the JCS that Green's proposal was the kind of information I want you all to give me next Tuesday when you come back to talk again. As the chiefs rose to leave, the photographer continued to move about the room to record the president's consultation with his military advisors. LBJ motioned for the chiefs to gather around his desk. Picking up a handful of the telegrams he had referred to earlier, the president told them, "This is the sort of thing I am up against. This is the sort of stuff I am getting from the public." Johnson then asked the officers to step outside into the garden for some additional photographs. During the second photo, Green switched positions with McDonald and stood next to the president. Having read the Johns Hopkins speech in the morning paper, the Marine Corps commandant sought to reassure the president, telling him that the speech was the best one given during the past administrations, and that he was sure that there were a lot of people in the country who felt just as I did. LBJ had performed well. Green was impressed by the clear worry that dominated the president's demeanor. To prevent the chiefs from questioning limitations on the use of force against the North, the president played for their sympathy, asking that they be team players. Lest the chiefs underestimate the seriousness with which he regarded their support, LBJ made veiled threats to relieve his military advisors or supplant their role. He said that he had considered sending General Shoup, the retired Marine Corps commandant, to take charge of the whole military situation in South Vietnam, but had decided against it because there were already too many generals out there. Unwilling to intensify the air campaign or deploy large numbers of U.S. troops to the south, he pressured the chiefs to kill more Viet Cong with troops and materiel currently available to them. Although he registered no objections during the meeting, Green recorded that the president does not seem to grasp the details of what can and cannot be done in Vietnam. Recognizing that temporizing measures would not produce tangible results, Green believed that the United States faced the difficult decision of either withdrawing from Vietnam or staying to fight a major campaign. In a memo that he passed out to his colleagues just prior to the meeting with the president, Green had recommended the immediate deployment of one Marine Expeditionary Force, one Army Division, and one South Korean Division to South Vietnam. After a 10-day grace period following the Johns Hopkins speech, the United States would commence a rapid, significant, sustained increase in pressures against North Vietnam, including unrestricted airstrikes on enemy military and industrial targets, the mining of Haiphong Harbor, shore bombardment of coastal and island targets, and seizure of the latter with South Vietnamese troops. Simultaneously, the United States would prepare for a total blockade of North Vietnamese ports and put the American economy on a wartime footing. The president, however, did not wish to make such a firm commitment to war, lest he alienate any of his constituencies. Secretary of Defense McNamara remained Johnson's principal assistant in pursuing a middle ground in Vietnam and in concealing from Congress and the public the fact that an expanded U.S. effort on the ground in South Vietnam was underway. The defense secretary told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that it will be the president's desire and purpose to consult with the Congress, the leadership of the Congress, members of this committee, before undertaking any combat moves of personnel that would potentially enlarge the war. Taylor assisted McNamara in this deception. Before he returned to Saigon, the ambassador had assured the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that no one is approaching a decision of this magnitude at this moment. He promised the senators that if a large-scale deployment was needed, you are going to be consulted, I am perfectly sure. Separately, Dean Rusk had assured Senator Church and his colleagues that large-scale troop deployments were not at all in contemplation, and that we would naturally consult with appropriate Senate leaders before we seriously considered such a step. Based on consultation with Taylor, Westmoreland sensed that the deployment of division-sized forces is not in the immediate offing, Accordingly, he suggested that he and the JCS work with the president's approach to gain approval for sending to Vietnam the largest number of troops possible without attracting intense congressional scrutiny. On April 11th, he suggested that the JCS recommend redeployment of the 173rd Airborne Brigade from Okinawa to the central highlands of South Vietnam. He reasoned, as he had earlier, that the deployment of brigade-sized forces from Okinawa would attract less public and congressional attention than that of division-sized forces from the United States. Westmoreland suggested that the JCS work within the constraints of the president's domestic agenda by gradually, rather than suddenly, expanding the U.S. commitment in Vietnam. On April 13th, the JCS and McNamara returned to the White House for lunch with the president. Johnson continued to play for sympathy from the chiefs while criticizing their performance. He thought it unfair that he had borne the blame for some 18 months by himself. If the situation in Vietnam continued to deteriorate, he threatened, he would share the blame with those who had been giving him advice. Johnson also remained determined to preempt discussion of an intensification of military actions against the North. He again made clear his intention to retain tight control over military operations. He promised more determined action in the future, however, and vowed to increase the tempo of bombing targets below the 20th parallel. Because the president limited the discussion to actions within South Vietnam and wished to maintain tight control over the air campaign against the North, Air Force Chief of Staff General McConnell restricted his recommendations to minor changes that he would carry out in-house without presidential approval. Similarly, Admiral McDonald indicated that the Navy was taking measures to improve sea surveillance of the North Vietnamese coast. Although he forestalled discussion of the air campaign against North Vietnam, Johnson professed enthusiasm for any JCS proposal to intensify the war in the South. He again emphasized that he would even move the JCS to Saigon to handle the situation themselves. LBJ assured the chiefs that he would invest whatever amount of money, materiel, or effort necessary to win the game in South Vietnam and start killing more Viet Cong. The president asked for Wheeler's recommendations. The chairman restated the JCS recommendation of March 20th that three divisions deploy to South Vietnam. As Wheeler spoke, the president began to calculate the total number of troops that would then be deployed in South Vietnam, arriving at a total of 180,000. Despite his pledge to commit to South Vietnam the forces the JCS deemed necessary, the president said that he could never get Congress to go along with that large a number of troops. Besides, the president noted, a large troop deployment might incite a reaction from North Vietnam and China. Unhappy with Wheeler's advice, the president indicated that he would be willing to approve the deployment of 5,000 troops instead of the 90,000 that would attend the deployment of three divisions. He made the point with an analogy. It is just as if you went to a bank owned by Mr. McNamara and asked him for a loan of $90,000, and he told you no, he couldn't let you have that amount, but he would loan you $5,000. What would you do? Let your business go into bankruptcy? Or would you take the $5,000 and try to do something with it? Johnson wanted the JCS to tell him how to reverse the deteriorating situation in South Vietnam cheaply and quickly. He told his senior military officers that he was willing to send a reasonable number of troops to South Vietnam, but was never going to agree at this time to three divisions. Something else on a smaller scale would have to be tried. After making his point, the president turned to Harold Johnson and asked for his assessment. When the Army Chief of Staff reiterated the JCS estimate that three divisions were the minimum force necessary, LBJ turned quickly to General Greene. The president was counting on the commandant of the Marine Corps, whom McNamara had earlier described to him as immature, to break with his colleagues and make a recommendation that would not precipitate a congressional debate. When the chiefs first arrived at the White House, LBJ had shaken the general's hand warmly and said in a low voice, "I want some good recommendations from you today." After General Johnson reinforced Wheeler's three-division proposal, the president addressed the group. "The last time you were over here, Wally Greene had a proposal to make, which we partially heard, that had to do with combined operations with the South Vietnamese. Now let's hear what he has to say." The president's pandering had the desired effect. Greene gave Johnson the advice he wanted. The commandant described a proposal for combined operations as a program that could be bought cheaply and might be successful. Johnson responded that he was willing to throw another chip on the table, amounting to 5,000 more U.S. Marines if necessary, in order to carry this plan out. Although McNamara interjected that Greene's proposal would require some study, the president remained enthusiastic. LBJ thought that this recommendation should be tried out, and if it failed, we wouldn't have lost and could go on and try something else. After his meeting with the chiefs, Johnson approved Westmoreland's request for the 173rd Airborne Brigade. The two April meetings between the president and the JCS added greater confusion to an already muddled strategic picture of what the U.S. military was to accomplish in Vietnam. The president's curtailment of their discussion to only those initiatives that would kill more Viet Cong prevented the development of a comprehensive plan for the war. Instead of defining policy goals precisely and then determining how military force might contribute to those goals, the president's discussion with the chiefs began with how much force he was willing to invest in the near term and assumed, with no thought for the nature of the war, that any action would constitute progress in the war effort. The chiefs were to make their recommendations not according to agreed-on objectives, but according to the means the president made available, based on domestic political priorities. In the absence of clearly defined strategic objectives, killing more Viet Cong, a tactical mission, became the basis for JCS plans and recommendations. After their meetings with the president, the JCS set the joint and service staffs to work to determine how we can increase the Viet Cong kill rate within the framework of our present posture in Southeast Asia. The JCS concluded that, with the current force levels, they might kill more Viet Cong through the massive application of air power in the South. It remained unclear, however, how the tactic of using massive airstrikes against an enemy who was intertwined with the non-combatant population would help to establish strategic conditions conducive to ending the war. Because the bombing of North Vietnam had incited opposition, the piecemeal introduction of small numbers of ground troops seemed to the president the path of least resistance. Through this course of action, Johnson might assuage the chief's desire for additional action while continuing to obscure the nature of America's growing military commitment from those who were opposed to military intervention in Vietnam. Public, congressional, and international opposition to bombing North Vietnam had dimmed the luster of what had been the politically cheap course of action. Although intensified action against the North might inflame emerging critics of the Vietnam policy, such as Senators Morse, Fulbright, and Church, a few more Marines or an Army brigade stationed in the Philippines might slip into South Vietnam without inciting a politically damaging debate. The president had used differences among the chiefs to his advantage before, and service parochialism continued to be a debilitating influence on the JCS. Green's desire to increase the Marine Corps role in Vietnam led him to spare the president the hard, cold facts that he and the Marine Corps staff had recorded in an estimate of the situation. Instead, he urged a cheap deployment of 5,000 more Marines, 100-fold fewer than he thought would ultimately be required to fight a major campaign. LBJ had impressed Green with his very forceful and impressive manner and had left the general with no doubt in my mind that he meant business and that he expected the Joint Chiefs to produce and that he wanted more Viet Cong killed. Wheeler recognized how Lyndon Johnson had manipulated the JCS, but he remained unwilling to confront his commander-in-chief. When he returned to the Pentagon, he summoned his colleagues to his office. Greatly distressed, he told the chiefs that they had been led into a trap. When Green asked Wheeler what he meant, the chairman responded heatedly that they had not stuck by their original agreement to hold fast on the chief's previous recommendation to introduce 3 divisions into South Vietnam. Green protested. Although he affirmed his support for the introduction of 3 divisions, he argued that he wasn't going to sit at the table and tell Mr. Johnson that I didn't have anything to say or refer him to the chairman, indicating that the chairman would speak for me. Green contended, furthermore, that his recommendations were perfectly sound, that everyone present had the opportunity to examine them and discuss them if they didn't like them, and that no one had done this. Wheeler, who had already reconciled himself to working for a gradual intensification of the war, suppressed his anger and got on with the business of deploying more troops to South Vietnam. On April 14th, he sent a message to Sinh Pak, MACV, and the Saigon Embassy, detailing the decisions that the president had made in his April 13th meeting with the JCS. He instructed the military commanders to accomplish the following actions as soon as Ambassador Taylor obtained approval from the South Vietnamese government. Deploy 173rd Airborne Brigade and necessary support elements to Ben Hoa, Vung Tau area, with the initial mission of security of U.S. installations and facilities. Expand initial mission to include engagement in counterinsurgency combat operations. The final paragraph of the JCS cable instructed addressees to make no public statements and ordered that the deployment be treated as low-key. In a separate cable, Wheeler informed Westmoreland that he would personally control and carefully monitor the initial Marine Corps offensive operations and directed that those operations begin with small patrols. Wheeler concluded that barring an emergency, he did not visualize battalion-size operations occurring for several weeks. Thus, despite his feeling that Johnson had trapped the JCS, Wheeler supported the president's deception of Congress and the American public about the changed nature of the American involvement in the war. Westmoreland, in response to Wheeler's instruction to keep the president's decisions low-key, suggested that the administration take the public stance that U.S. ground forces were merely providing support for South Vietnamese units rather than conducting independent offensive operations. Chapter 14, War Without Direction, April to June, 1965. LBJ played a role between the Doves and the Hawks, and he did it in much the same way he used to conduct his majority leadership. He did it on the notion that here was some middle ground, always, on which the majority of the votes could be secured. That was true in the Senate, where you have to find that consensus in order to enact legislation. But I think the role of the president is different from that of a senator, and that this was a matter of policy that could not be cut down the middle. And his constant attempt to do it led him always to temper the military on the one hand, and yet to generally move in the direction of larger warfare, reluctantly reaching out left and right